to spin and weave it for him. The extra labour expended in flax spinning realised itself formally in extra income to numerous peasant families, or maybe, in Frederick II's time, in taxes pour le roi de Prusse. It realises itself now in profit for a few capitalists. The spindles and looms, formerly scattered over the face of the country, are now crowded together in a few great labour barracks, together with the labourers and the raw material. And spindles, looms, raw material are now transformed from means of independent existence for the spinners and weavers into means for commanding them and sucking out of them unpaid labour. Footnote. I will allow you, says the capitalist, to have the honour of serving me on condition that, in return for the pains I take in commanding you, you give me the little that remains to you. J. J. Rousseau, Discours sur l'économie politique. End of footnote. One does not perceive, when looking at the large manufactories and the large farms, that they have originated from the throwing into one of many small centres of production and have been built up by the expropriation of many small independent producers. Nevertheless, the popular intuition was not at fault. In the time of Mirabeau, the lion of the revolution, the great manufactories were still called manufactures réunies, workshops thrown into one, as we speak of fields thrown into one. Says Mirabeau, we are only paying attention to the grand manufactories in which hundreds of men work under a director and which are commonly called manufactures réunies. Those where a very large number of labourers work, each separately and on his own account, are hardly considered. They are placed at an infinite distance from the others. This is a great error, as the latter alone make a really important object of national prosperity. The large workshop, Manufacture Réunie, will enrich prodigiously one or two entrepreneurs, but the labourers will only be journeymen, paid more or less, and will not have any share in the success of the undertaking. In the discrete workshop, Manufacture Séparée, on the contrary, no one will become rich, but many labourers will be comfortable. The saving and the industrious will be able to amass a little capital, to put by a little for a birth of a child, for an illness, for themselves or their belongings. The number of saving and industrious labourers will increase, because they will see in good conduct, in activity, a means of essentially bettering their condition, and not of obtaining a small rise in wages that can never be of any importance of the future, and whose sole result is to place men in the position to live a little better, but only from day to day. The large workshops, undertakings of certain private persons who pay labourers from day to day to work for their gain, may be able to put these private individuals at their ease, but they will never be an object worth the attention of governments. Discreet workshops, for the most part, combined with cultivation of small holdings, are the only free ones. Footnote. That Mirabeau considers the separate workshops more economical and productive than the combined, and sees in the latter merely artificial exotics under government cultivation, is explained by the position at that time of a great part of the continental manufacturers. End of footnote. The expropriation and eviction of a part of the agricultural population, not only set free for industrial capital the labourers, their means of subsistence and material for labour, it also created the home market. In fact, the events that transformed the small peasants into wage labourers, and their means of subsistence and of labour into material elements of capital, created at the same time a home market for the latter. Formerly, The peasant family produced the means of subsistence and the raw materials which they themselves, for the most part, consumed. These raw materials and means of subsistence have now become commodities. The large farmer sells them. He finds his market in manufactures. Yarn, linen, coarse woolen stuffs, things whose raw materials had been within the reach of every peasant family, had been spun and woven by it for its own use, were now transformed into articles of manufacture, to which the country districts at once served for markets. The many scattered customers, whom stray artisans until now had found in the numerous small producers working on their own account, concentrate themselves now into one great market provided for by industrial capital. Footnote. 20 pounds of wool, converted unobtrusively into yearly clothing of a labourer's family by its own industry in the intervals of other works, this makes no show. But bring it to market, send it to the factory, thence to the broker, thence to the dealer, and you will have great commercial operations and nominal capital engaged to the amount of 20 times its value. The working class is thus immersed to support a wretched factory population, a parasitical shopkeeping class, and a fictitious commercial, monetary, and financial system. David Urquhart, end of footnote. Thus, hand in hand with the expropriation of the self-supporting peasants, with their separation from their means of production, goes the destruction of rural domestic industry, the process of separation between manufacture and agriculture. And only the destruction of rural domestic industry can give the internal market of a country that extension and consistence which the capitalist mode of production requires. Still, the manufacturing period, properly so called, does not succeed in carrying out this transformation radically and completely. It will be remembered that manufacture, properly so called, conquers but partially the domain of national production, and always rests on the handicrafts of the town and the domestic industry of the rural districts as its ultimate basis. If it destroys these in one form, in particular branches at certain points, it calls them up again elsewhere, because it needs them for the preparation of raw material up to a certain point. It produces, therefore, a new class of small villagers who, while following the cultivation of the soil as an accessory calling, find their chief occupation in industrial labour, the products of which they sell to the manufacturers directly or through the medium of merchants. This is one, though not the chief, cause of a phenomenon which, at first, puzzles the student of English history. From the last third of the 15th century, he finds continually complaints, only interrupted at certain intervals, about the encroachment of capitalist farming in the country districts and the progressive destruction of the peasantry. Footnote. Cromwell's time forms an exception. So long as the Republic lasted, the mass of the English people of all grades rose from the degradation into which they had sunk under the Tudors. End of footnote. On the other hand, the student always finds this peasantry turning up again, although in diminished number, and always under worse conditions. The chief reason is, England is at one time chiefly a cultivator of corn, at another chiefly a breeder of cattle in alternate periods, and with these the extent of peasant cultivation fluctuates. Modern industry alone, and finally, supplies, in machinery, the lasting basis of capitalist agriculture, expropriates radically the enormous majority of the agricultural population, and completes the separation between agriculture and rural domestic industry, whose roots, spinning and weaving, it tears up. Footnote. Tuckett is aware that the modern woolen industry has sprung, with the introduction of machinery, from manufacture proper and from the destruction of rural and domestic industries. The plough, the yoke, were the invention of gods and the occupation of heroes. Are the loom, the spindle, the distaff of less noble parentage? You sever the distaff and the plough, the spindle and the yoke, and you get factories and poorhouses, credit and panics, two hostile nations, agriculture and commercial. David Urquhart. But now comes Carey and cries out upon England, surely not with unreason, that it is trying to turn every other country into a mere agricultural nation, whose manufacturer is to be England. He pretends that in this way Turkey has been ruined, because the owners and occupants of land have never been permitted by England to strengthen themselves by the formation of that natural alliance between the plough and the loom, the hammer and the harrow. The slave trade. According to him, Urquhart himself is one of the chief agents in the ruin of Turkey, where he had made free trade propaganda in the English interest. The best of it is that Carey, a great Russophile, by the way, wants to prevent the process of separation by that very system of protection which accelerates it. End of footnote. Modern industry, therefore, also, for the first time, conquers for industrial capital the entire home market. Footnote. Philanthropic English economists like Mill, Rogers, Goldwin Smith, Fawcett, etc., and liberal manufacturers like John Bright and Co., ask the English landed proprietors, as God asked Cain after Abel, where are our thousands of freeholders gone? But where do you come from, then? From the destruction of those freeholders. Why don't you ask further? Where are the independent weavers, spinners, and artisans gone? End of footnote. Chapter 31. The Genesis of the Industrial Capitalist. The genesis of the industrial capitalist did not proceed in such a gradual way as that of the farmer. Footnote. Industrial here in contradistinction to agricultural. In the categoric sense, the farmer is an industrial capitalist as much as the manufacturer. End of footnote. Doubtless many small guild masters and yet more independent small artisans or even wage labourers transformed themselves into small capitalists and, by gradually extending exploitation of wage labour and corresponding accumulation, into full-blown capitalists. In the infancy of capitalist production, things often happened as in the infancy of medieval towns, where the question, which of the escaped serfs should be master and which servant, was in great part decided by the earlier or later date of their flight. The snail's pace of this method corresponded in no wise with the commercial requirements of the New World market that the great discoveries of the end of the 15th century created. But the Middle Ages had handed down two distinct forms of capital, which mature in the most different economic-social formations, and which, before the era of the capitalist mode of production, are considered as capital quand même, all the same. Usurer's capital, and merchant's capital. At present, all the wealth of society goes first into the possession of the capitalist. He pays the landowner his rent, the labourer his wages, the tax and tithe-gatherer their claims, and keeps a large, indeed the largest, and a continually augmenting share of the annual produce of labour for himself. The capitalist may now be said to be the first owner of all the wealth in the community, though no law has conferred on him the right to this property. This change has been effected by the taking of interest on capital, and it is not a little curious that all the lawgivers of Europe endeavoured to prevent this by statutes, viz. Statutes against usury. the power of the capitalist over all the wealth of the country is a complete change in the right of property, and by what law or series of laws was it effected? Footnote: The Natural and Artificial Rights of Property Contrasted, 1832. Author of the anonymous work, Thomas Hodgkin. End of footnote. The author should have remembered that revolutions are not made by laws. The money capital formed by means of usury and commerce was prevented from turning into industrial capital in the country by the feudal constitution, in the towns by the guild organization. Footnote: Even as late as 1794, the small cloth makers of Leeds sent a deputation to Parliament with a petition for a law to forbid any merchant from becoming a manufacturer. Dr. Aikin. End of footnote. These fetters vanished with the dissolution of feudal society, with the expropriation and partial eviction of the country population. The new manufactures were established at seaports or at inland points beyond the control of the old municipalities and their guilds. Hence, in England, an embittered struggle of the corporate towns against these new industrial nurseries. The discovery of gold and silver in America, the extirpation, enslavement, and entombment in mines of the aboriginal population, the beginning of the conquest and looting of the East Indies, the turning of Africa into a warren for the commercial hunting of black skins, signalized the rosy dawn of the era of capitalist production. These idyllic proceedings are the chief mementa of primitive accumulation. On their heels treads the commercial war of the European nations, with the globe for a theatre. It begins with the revolt of the Netherlands from Spain, assumes giant dimensions in England's anti-Jacobin War, and is still going on in the Opium Wars against China, etc. The different momenta of primitive accumulation distribute themselves now more or less in chronological order, particularly over Spain, Portugal, Holland, France, and England. In England, at the end of the 17th century, they arrive at a systematical combination, embracing the colonies, the national debt, the modern mode of taxation, and the protectionist system. These methods depend in part on brute force, for example, the colonial system. But they all employ the power of the state, the concentrated and organized force of society, to hasten, hothouse fashion, the process of transformation of the feudal mode of production into the capitalist mode, and to shorten the transition. Force is the midwife of every old society pregnant with a new one. It is itself an economic power. Of the Christian colonial system, W. Howitt, a man who makes a speciality of Christianity, says, "The barbarities and desperate outrages of the so-called Christian race throughout every region of the world and upon every people they have been able to subdue are not to be paralleled by those of any other race, however fierce, however untaught, and however reckless of mercy and of shame, in any age of the earth." Footnote: William Howitt, Colonization and Christianity, A Popular History of the Treatment of the Natives by the Europeans in All Their Colonies, London, 1838. On the treatment of the slaves, there is a good compilation in Charles Comte's Traité de la Législation, 3rd edition, Brussels, 1837. This subject one must study in detail to see what the bourgeoisie makes of itself and of the labourer, wherever it can, without restraint, model the world after its own image. End of footnote. The history of the colonial administration of Holland, and Holland was the head capitalistic nation of the 17th century, is one of the most extraordinary relations of treachery, bribery, massacre, and meanness. Footnote: Thomas Stamford Raffles, late Lieutenant Governor of that island. The History of Java, 1817. End of footnote. Nothing is more characteristic than their system of stealing men to get slaves for Java. The men-stealers were trained for this purpose. The thief, the interpreter, and the seller were the chief agents in this trade. Native princes, the chief sellers. The young people stolen were thrown into the secret dungeons of Celebes until they were ready for sending to the slave ships. An official report says, "This one town of Macassar, for example, is full of secret prisons, one more horrible than the other, crammed with unfortunates, victims of greed and tyranny, fettered in chains, forcibly torn from their families." To secure Malacca, the Dutch corrupted the Portuguese governor. He let them into the town in 1641. They hurried at once to his house and assassinated him, to abstain from the payment of £21,875, the price of his treason. Wherever they set foot, devastation and depopulation followed. Banjawangi, a province of Java, in 1750 numbered over 80,000 inhabitants. In 1811, only 18,000. Sweet commerce. The English East India Company, as is well known, obtained, besides the political rule in India, the exclusive monopoly of the tea trade, as well as of the Chinese trade in general, and of the transport of goods to and from Europe. But the coasting trade of India, and between the islands, as well as the internal trade of India, were the monopoly of the higher employés of the company. The monopolies of salt, opium, betel, and other commodities were inexhaustible mines of wealth. The employés themselves fixed the price and plundered at will the unhappy Hindus. The Governor-General took part in this private traffic. His favourites received contracts under conditions whereby they, cleverer than the alchemists, made gold out of nothing. Great fortunes sprang up like mushrooms in a day. Primitive accumulation went on without the advance of a shilling. The trial of Warren Hastings swarms with such cases. Here is an instance. A contract for opium was given to a certain Sullivan at the moment of his departure on an official mission to a part of India far removed from the opium district. Sullivan sold his contract to one Bin for £40,000. Bin sold it the same day for £60,000. And the ultimate purchaser, who carried out the contract, declared that, after all, he realized an enormous gain. According to one of the lists laid before Parliament, the company and its employés, from 1757 to 1766, got £6 million from the Indians as gifts. Between 1769 and 1770, the English manufactured a famine by buying up all the rice and refusing to sell it again except at fabulous prices. Footnote: in the year 1866, more than 1 million Hindus died of hunger in the province of Orissa alone. Nevertheless, the attempt was made to enrich the Indian treasury by the price at which the necessaries of life were sold to the starving people. End of footnote. The treatment of the aborigines was, naturally, most frightful in plantation colonies destined for export trade only, such as the West Indies, and in rich and well-populated countries such as Mexico and India, that were given over to plunder. But even in the colonies properly so called, the Christian character of primitive accumulation did not belie itself. Those sober virtuosi of Protestantism, the Puritans of New England, in 1703, by decrees of their assembly, set a premium of £40 on every Indian scalp and every captured redskin. In 1720, a premium of £100 on every scalp. In 1744, after Massachusetts Bay had proclaimed a certain tribe as rebels, the following prices: for a male scalp of 12 years and upwards, £100, new currency; for a male prisoner, £105, for women and children prisoners, £50, for scalps of women and children, £50. Some decades later, the colonial system took its revenge on the descendants of the pious Pilgrim Fathers, who had grown seditious in the meantime. At English instigation, and for English pay, they were tomahawked by redskins. The British Parliament proclaimed bloodhounds and scalping as means that God and nature had given into its hand. The colonial system ripened like a hothouse trade and navigation. The society's monopolia of Luther were powerful levers for concentration of capital. The colonies secured a market for the budding manufactures, and, through the monopoly of the market, an increased accumulation. The treasures captured outside Europe by undisguised looting, enslavement, and murder floated back to the mother country and were turned into capital. Holland, which first fully developed the colonial system, in 1648 stood already in the acme of its commercial greatness. It was in almost exclusive possession of the East Indian trade and the commerce between the southeast and northwest of Europe. Its fisheries, marine, manufactures surpassed those of any other country. The total capital of the Republic was probably more important than that of all the rest of Europe put together. Gulick forgets to add that by 1648 the people of Holland were more overworked, poorer, and more brutally oppressed than those of all the rest of Europe put together. Today, industrial supremacy implies commercial supremacy. In the period of manufacture properly so called, it is, on the other hand, the commercial supremacy that gives industrial predominance. Hence the preponderant role that the colonial system plays at that time. It was the strange god who perched himself on the altar cheek by jowl with the old gods of Europe, and one fine day, with a shove and a kick, chucked them all of a heap. It proclaimed surplus value-making as the sole end and aim of humanity. The system of public credit, that is, of national debts, whose origin we discover in Genoa and Venice as early as the Middle Ages, took possession of Europe generally during the manufacturing period. The colonial system, with its maritime trade and commercial wars, served as a forcing house for it. Thus it first took root in Holland. National debts, that is, the alienation of the state, whether despotic, constitutional, or republican, marked with its stamp the capitalistic era. The only part of the so-called national wealth that actually enters into the collective possessions of modern peoples is their national debt. Hence, as a necessary consequence, the modern doctrine that a nation becomes the richer the more deeply it is in debt. Public credit becomes the credo of capital. Footnote: William Cobbett remarks that in England, all public institutions are designated royal. As compensation for this, however, there is the national debt. End of footnote. And with the rise of national debt-making, want of faith in the national debt takes the place of the blasphemy against the Holy Ghost, which may not be forgiven. The public debt becomes one of the most powerful levers of primitive accumulation. As with the stroke of an enchanter's wand, it endows barren money with the power of breeding and thus turns it into capital, without the necessity of its exposing itself to the troubles and risks inseparable from its employment in industry or even in usury. the state creditors actually give nothing away, for the sum lent is transformed into public bonds, easily negotiable, which go on functioning in their hands just as so much hard cash would. But further, apart from the class of lazy annuitants thus created, and from the improvised wealth of the financiers, middlemen between the government and the nation, as also apart from the tax farmers, merchants, private manufacturers, to whom a good part of every national loan renders the service of a capital fallen from heaven, the national debt has given rise to joint stock companies, to dealings in negotiable effects of all kinds, and agiotage, in a word, to stock exchange gambling and the modern bankocracy. At their birth, the great banks, decorated with national titles, were only associations of private speculators who placed themselves by the side of governments and, thanks to the privileges they received, were in a position to advance money to the state. Hence the accumulation of the national debt has no more infallible measure than the successive rise in the stock of these banks, whose full development dates from the founding of the Bank of England in 1694. The Bank of England began with lending its money to the government at 8%. At the same time, it was empowered by Parliament to coin money out of the same capital, by lending it again to the public in the form of banknotes. It was allowed to use these notes for discounting bills, making advances on commodities, and for buying the precious metals. It was not long ere this credit money, made by the bank itself, became the coin in which the Bank of England made its loans to the state, and paid, on account of the state, the interest on the public debt. It was not enough that the bank gave with one hand and took back more with the other. It remained, even whilst receiving, the eternal creditor of the nation down to the last shilling advanced. Gradually it became, inevitably, the receptacle of the metallic hoard of the country, and the centre of gravity of all commercial credit. What effect was produced on their contemporaries by the sudden uprising of this brood of bankocrats, financiers, rentiers, brokers, stock-jobbers, etc., is proved by the writings of that time, for example, by Bolingbroke's. Footnote: if the Tartars were to flood into Europe today, it would be a difficult job to make them understand what a financier is with us. Montesquieu, Esprit des Lois, 1769, end of footnote. With the national debt arose an international credit system, which often conceals one of the sources of primitive accumulation in this or that people. Thus, the villainies of the Venetian thieving system formed one of the secret bases of the capital wealth of Holland, to whom Venice in her decadence lent large sums of money. So also was it with Holland and England. By the beginning of the 18th century, the Dutch manufacturers were far outstripped. Holland had ceased to be the nation preponderant in commerce and industry. One of its main lines of business, therefore, from 1701 to 1776, is the lending out of enormous amounts of capital, especially to its great rival, England. The same thing is going on today between England and the United States. A great deal of capital, which appears today in the United States without any certificate of birth, was yesterday, in England, the capitalized blood of children. As the national debt finds its support in the public revenue, which must cover the yearly payments for interest, etc., the modern system of taxation was the necessary complement of the system of national loans. The loans enable the government to meet extraordinary expenses, without the taxpayers feeling it immediately, but they necessitate, as a consequence, increased taxes. On the other hand, the raising of taxation caused by the accumulation of debts contracted one after another compels the government always to have recourse to new loans for new extraordinary expenses. Modern fiscality, whose pivot is formed by taxes on the most necessary means of subsistence, thereby increasing their price, thus contains within itself the germ of automatic progression. Overtaxation is not an incident, but rather a principle. In Holland, therefore, where this system was first inaugurated, the great patriot De Witt has, in his Maxims, extolled it as the best system for making the wage labourer submissive, frugal, industrious, and overburdened with labour. The destructive influence that it exercises on the condition of the wage labourer concerns us less, however, here, than the forcible expropriation resulting from it of peasants, artisans, and, in a word, all elements of the lower middle class. On this there are not two opinions, even among the bourgeois economists. Its expropriating efficacy is still further heightened by the system of protection, which forms one of its integral parts. The great part that the public debt and the fiscal system corresponding with it has played in the capitalization of wealth and the expropriation of the masses has led many writers, like Cobbett, Doubleday and others, to seek in this, incorrectly, the fundamental cause of the misery of the modern peoples. The system of protection was an artificial means of manufacturing manufacturers, of expropriating independent labourers, of capitalizing the national means of production and subsistence, of forcibly abbreviating the transition from the medieval to the modern mode of production. The European states tore one another to pieces about the patent of this invention, and, once entered into the service of the surplus-value makers, did not merely lay under contribution in the pursuit of this purpose their own people, indirectly through protective duties, directly through export premiums, they also forcibly rooted out, in their dependent countries, all industry, as, for example, England did with the Irish woolen manufacture. On the continent of Europe, after Colbert's example, the process was much simplified. The primitive industrial capital here came, in part, directly out of the state treasury. "Why," cries Mirabeau, "why go so far to seek the cause of the manufacturing glory of Saxony before the war? 180 million of debts contracted by the sovereigns. Colonial system, public debts, heavy taxes, protection, commercial wars, etc. These children of the true manufacturing period increased gigantically during the infancy of modern industry. The birth of the latter is heralded by a great slaughter of the innocents. Like the Royal Navy, the factories were recruited by means of the press gang." Blasé as Sir F. M. Eden is as to the horrors of the expropriation of the agricultural population from the soil from the last third of the 15th century to his own time, with all the self-satisfaction with which he rejoices in this process essential for establishing capitalistic agriculture and the due proportion between arable and pasture land, he does not show, however, the same economic insight in respect to the necessity of child-stealing and child-slavery for the transformation of manufacturing exploitation into factory exploitation, and the establishment of the true relation between capital and labour power. He says, "It may perhaps be worthy the attention of the public to consider whether any manufacture, which, in order to be carried on successfully, requires that cottages and workhouses should be ransacked for poor children, that they should be employed by turns during the greater part of the night and robbed of that rest which, though indispensable to all, is most required by the young, and that numbers of both sexes of different ages and dispositions should be collected together in such a manner that the contagion of example cannot but lead to profligacy and debauchery, will add to the sum of individual or national felicity. In the counties of Derbyshire, Nottinghamshire, and more particularly in Lancashire, says Fielden, the newly invented machinery was used in large factories built on the sides of streams capable of turning the water wheel. Thousands of hands were suddenly required in these places, remote from towns. And Lancashire, in particular, being till then comparatively thinly populated and barren, a population was all that she now wanted. The small and nimble fingers of little children being by very far the most in request, the custom instantly sprang up of procuring apprentices from the different parish workhouses of London, Birmingham, and elsewhere. Many, many thousands of these little hapless creatures were sent down into the north, being from the age of 7 to the age of 13 or 14 years old. The custom was for the master to clothe his apprentices and to feed and lodge them in an apprentice house near the factory. Overseers were appointed to see to the works, whose interest it was to work the children to the utmost, because their pay was in proportion to the quantity of work that they could exact. Cruelty was, of course, the consequence. In many of the manufacturing districts, but particularly, I am afraid, in the guilty county to which I belong, Lancashire, cruelties the most heart-rending were practised upon the unoffending and friendless creatures who were thus consigned to the charge of master manufacturers. They were harassed to the brink of death by excess of labour, were flogged, fettered and tortured in the most exquisite refinement of cruelty. They were, in many cases, starved to the bone while flogged to their work, and, even in some instances, were driven to commit suicide. The beautiful and romantic valleys of Derbyshire, Nottinghamshire, and Lancashire, secluded from the public eye, became the dismal solitudes of torture and of many a murder. The profits of manufacturers were enormous, but this only whetted the appetite that it should have satisfied, and therefore the manufacturers had recourse to an expedient that seemed to secure to them those profits without any possibility of limit. They began the practice of what is termed night working, that is, having tired one set of hands by working them throughout the day, they had another set ready to go on working throughout the night, the day set getting into the beds that the night set had just quitted, and in their turn again the night set getting into the beds that the day set quitted in the morning. It is a common tradition in Lancashire that the beds never get cold. Footnote, John Fielden. On the earlier infamies of the factory system. Cf. Dr. Aikin, 1795, and Gisborne, Inquiry into the Duties of Men, 1795. When the steam engine transplanted the factories from the country waterfalls to the middle of towns, the abstemious surplus-value maker found the child material ready to his hand, without being forced to seek slaves from the workhouses. When Sir R. Peel, father of the Minister of Plausibility, brought in his bill for the protection of children in 1815, Francis Homer, lumen of the Billion Committee and intimate friend of Ricardo, said in the House of Commons, "It is notorious that, with a bankrupt's effects, a gang, if he might use the word, of these children had been put up to sale, and were advertised publicly as part of the property. A most atrocious instance had been brought before the Court of King's Bench 2 years before, in which a number of these boys, apprenticed by a parish in London to one manufacturer, had been transferred to another and had been found by some benevolent persons in a state of absolute famine. Another case, more horrible, had come to his knowledge while on a parliamentary committee, that not many years ago an agreement had been made between a London parish and a Lancashire manufacturer by which it was stipulated that with every 20 sound children, one idiot should be taken. End of footnote. With the development of capitalist production during the manufacturing period, the public opinion of Europe had lost the last remnant of shame and conscience. The nations bragged cynically of every infamy that served them as a means to capitalistic accumulation. Read, for example, the naive annals of commerce of the worthy A. Anderson. Here it is trumpeted forth as a triumph of English statecraft that at the Peace of Utrecht, England extorted from the Spaniards, by the Asiento Treaty, the privilege of being allowed to ply the Negro trade, until then only carried on between Africa and the English West Indies, between Africa and Spanish America as well. England thereby acquired the right of supplying Spanish America until 1743 with 4,800 Negroes yearly. This threw, at the same time, an official cloak over British smuggling. Liverpool waxed fat on the slave trade. This was its method of primitive accumulation. And even to the present day, Liverpool respectability is the Pindar of the slave trade, which, compare the work of Aiken, 1795, already quoted, has coincided with that spirit of bold adventure which has characterized the trade of Liverpool and rapidly carried it to its present state of prosperity, has occasioned vast employment for shipping and sailors, and greatly augmented the demand for the manufactures of the country. Liverpool employed in the slave trade, in 1730, 15 ships. In 1751, 53. In 1760, 74. In 1770, 96. And in 1792, 132. Footnote. In 1790, there were in the English West Indies 10 slaves for one free man. In the French, 14 for one, and in the Dutch, 23 for one. Henry Brougham, An Inquiry into the Colonial Policy of the European Powers, 1803, end of footnote. Whilst the cotton industry introduced child slavery in England, it gave in the United States a stimulus to the transformation of the earlier more or less patriarchal slavery into a system of commercial exploitation. In fact, the veiled slavery of the wage workers in Europe needed, for its pedestal, slavery pure and simple in the New World. Tantae mollis erat, so great a task it was, to establish the eternal laws of nature of the capitalist mode of production, to complete the process of separation between labourers and conditions of labour, to transform, at one pole, the social means of production and subsistence into capital, and, at the opposite pole, the mass of the population into wage labourers, into free labouring poor, that artificial product of modern society. Footnote. The phrase, labouring poor, is found in English legislation from the moment when the class of wage labourers becomes noticeable. This term is used in opposition, on the one hand, to the idle poor, beggars, etc., on the other, to those labourers who, pigeons not yet plucked, are still possessors of their own means of labour. From the statute book, it passed into political economy and was handed down by Culpepper, J. Child, etc., to Adam Smith and Eden. After this, one can judge of the good faith of the execrable political cantmonger, Edmund Burke, when he called the expression labouring poor execrable political cant. This sycophant, who, in the pay of the English oligarchy, played the romantic laudator temporis acti, one who praises past times, against the French Revolution, just as, in the pay of the North American colonies at the beginning of the American Troubles, he had played the liberal against the English oligarchy, was an out-and-out vulgar bourgeois. The laws of commerce are the laws of nature, and therefore the laws of God. E. Burke. No wonder that, true to the laws of God and nature, he always sold himself in the best market. A very good portrait of this Edmund Burke, during his liberal time, is to be found in the writings of the Reverend Mr. Tucker. Tucker was a parson and a Tory, but, for the rest, an honourable man, and a competent political economist. In face of the infamous cowardice of character that reigns today and believes most devoutly in the laws of commerce, it is our bounden duty again and again to brand the Burkes, who only differ from their successors in one thing. Talent. End of footnote. If money, according to Augier, footnote, Marie Augier, du Crédit Public, Paris, 1842, end of footnote, comes into the world with a congenital bloodstain on one cheek, capital comes dripping from head to foot from every pore with blood and dirt. Footnote. Capital is said by a Quarterly Reviewer to fly turbulence and strife, and to be timid, which is very true, but this is very incompletely stating the question. Capital eschews no profit, or very small profit, just as nature was formerly said to abhor a vacuum. With adequate profit, capital is very bold. A certain 10% will ensure its employment anywhere. 20% certain will produce eagerness. 50% positive audacity. 100% will make it ready to trample on all human laws. 300%, and there is not a crime at which it will scruple, nor a risk it will not run, even to the chance of its owner being hanged. If turbulence and strife will bring a profit, it will freely encourage both. Smuggling and the slave trade have amply proved all that is here stated. T.J. Dunning, end of footnote. Chapter 32, Historical Tendency of Capitalist Accumulation. What does the primitive accumulation of capital, that is, its historical genesis, resolve itself into? Insofar as it is not immediate transformation of slaves and serfs into wage labourers, and therefore a mere change of form, it only means the expropriation of the immediate producers, that is, the dissolution of private property based on the labour of its owner. Private property, as the antithesis to social collective property, exists only where the means of labour and the external conditions of labour belong to private individuals. But according as these private individuals are labourers or not labourers, private property has a different character. The numberless shades that it at first sight presents correspond to the intermediate stages lying between these two extremes. The private property of the labourer in his means of production is the foundation of petty industry, whether agricultural, manufacturing, or both. Petty industry, again, is an essential condition for the development of social production and of the free individuality of the labourer himself. Of course, this petty mode of production exists also under slavery, serfdom, and other states of dependence. But it flourishes, it lets loose its whole energy, it attains its adequate classical form, only where the labourer is the private owner of his own means of labour set in action by himself. The peasant of the land which he cultivates, the artisan of the tool which he handles as a virtuoso. This mode of production presupposes parcelling of the soil and scattering of the other means of production. As it excludes the concentration of these means of production, so also it excludes cooperation, division of labour within each separate process of production, the control over and the productive application of the forces of nature by society, and the free development of the social productive powers. It is compatible only with a system of production and a society moving within narrow and more or less primitive bounds. To perpetuate it would be, as Pecqueur rightly says, to decree universal mediocrity. At a certain stage of development, it brings forth the material agencies for its own dissolution. From that moment, new forces and new passions spring up in the bosom of society. But the old social organization fetters them and keeps them down. It must be annihilated. It is annihilated. Its annihilation, the transformation of the individualized and scattered means of production into socially concentrated ones, of the pygmy property of the many into the huge property of the few, the expropriation of the great mass of the people from the soil, from the means of subsistence, and from the means of labour, this fearful and painful expropriation of the mass of the people forms the prelude to the history of capital. It comprises a series of forcible methods, of which we have passed in review only those that have been epoch-making as methods of the primitive accumulation of capital. The expropriation of the immediate producers was accomplished with merciless vandalism, and under the stimulus of passions, the most infamous, the most sordid, the pettiest, the most meanly odious. Self-earned private property that is based, so to say, on the fusing together of the isolated, independent, labouring individual with the conditions of his labour, is supplanted by capitalistic private property, which rests on exploitation of the nominally free labour of others, that is, on wage labour. Footnote: we are in a situation which is entirely new for society. We are striving to separate every kind of property from every kind of labour. Sismondi, Nouveau Principe d'Economie Politique. End of footnote. As soon as this process of transformation has sufficiently decomposed the old society from top to bottom, as soon as the labourers are turned into proletarians, their means of labour into capital, as soon as the capitalist mode of production stands on its own feet, then the further socialization of labour and further transformation of the land and other means of production into socially exploited and therefore common means of production, as well as the further expropriation of private proprietors, takes a new form. That which is now to be expropriated is no longer the labourer working for himself, but the capitalist exploiting many labourers. This expropriation is accomplished by the action of the immanent laws of capitalist production itself, by the centralization of capital. One capitalist always kills many. Hand in hand with this centralization, or this expropriation of many capitalists by few, develop on an ever-extending scale the cooperative form of the labour process, the conscious technical application of science, the methodical cultivation of the soil, the transformation of the instruments of labour into instruments of labour only usable in common, the economising of all means of production by their use as means of production of combined, socialised labour, the entanglement of all peoples in the net of the world market, and with this, the international character of the capitalistic regime. Along with the constantly diminishing number of the magnates of capital, who usurp and monopolize all advantages of this process of transformation, grows the mass of misery, oppression, slavery, degradation, exploitation. But with this, too, grows the revolt of the working class, a class always increasing in numbers, and disciplined, united, organized by the very mechanism of the process of capitalist production itself. The monopoly of capital becomes a fetter upon the mode of production, which has sprung up and flourished along with and under it. Centralization of the means of production and socialization of labor at last reach a point where they become incompatible with their capitalist integument. This integument is burst asunder. The knell of capitalist private property sounds. The expropriators are expropriated. The capitalist mode of appropriation, the result of the capitalist mode of production, produces capitalist private property. This is the first negation of individual private property as founded on the labor of the proprietor. But capitalist production begets, with the inexorability of a law of nature, its own negation. It is the negation of negation. This does not re-establish private property for the producer, but gives him individual property based on the acquisition of the capitalist era, that is, on cooperation and the possession in common of the land and of the means of production. The transformation of scattered private property, arising from individual labour, into capitalist private property is, naturally, a process incomparably more protracted, violent, and difficult than the transformation of capitalistic private property, already practically resting on socialized production, into socialized property. In the former case, we had the expropriation of the mass of the people by a few usurpers. In the latter, we have the expropriation of a few usurpers by the mass of the people. Footnote. The advance of industry, whose involuntary promoter is the bourgeoisie, replaces the isolation of the labourers due to competition by their revolutionary combination due to association. The development of modern industry, therefore, cuts from under its feet the very foundation on which the bourgeoisie produces and appropriates products. What the bourgeoisie therefore produces, above all, are its own grave diggers. Its fall and the victory of the proletariat are equally inevitable. Of all the classes that stand face to face with the bourgeoisie today, the proletariat alone is a really revolutionary class. The other classes perish and disappear in the face of modern industry. The proletariat is its special and essential product. The lower middle classes, the small manufacturers, the shopkeepers, the artisan, the peasant, all these fight against the bourgeoisie to save from extinction their existence as fractions of the middle class. They are reactionary, for they try to roll back the wheel of history. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, Manifest der Kommunistischen Partei, London, 1848. End of footnote. Chapter 33. The Modern Theory of Colonization. Footnote. We treat here of real colonies, virgin soils, colonized by free immigrants. The United States are, speaking economically, still only a colony of Europe. Besides, to this category belong such old plantations as those in which the abolition of slavery has completely altered the earlier conditions. End of footnote. Political economy confuses on principle two very different kinds of private property, of which one rests on the producer's own labour, the other on the employment of the labour of others. It forgets that the latter not only is the direct antithesis of the former, but absolutely grows on its tomb only. In Western Europe, the home of political economy, the process of primitive accumulation is more or less accomplished. Here the capitalist regime has either directly conquered the whole domain of national production, or, where economic conditions are less developed, it at least indirectly controls those strata of society which, though belonging to the antiquated mode of production, continue to exist side by side with it in gradual decay. To this ready-made world of capital, the political economist applies the notions of law and of property inherited from a pre-capitalistic world with all the more anxious zeal and all the greater unction the more loudly the facts cry out in the face of his ideology. It is otherwise in the colonies. There the capitalist regime everywhere comes into collision with the resistance of the producer, who, as owner of his own conditions of labour, employs that labour to enrich himself, instead of the capitalist. The contradiction of these two diametrically opposed economic systems manifests itself here practically in a struggle between them. Where the capitalist has at his back the power of the mother country, he tries to clear out of his way by force the modes of production and appropriation based on the independent labour of the producer. The same interest, which compels the sycophant of capital, the political economist, in the mother country to proclaim the theoretical identity of the capitalist mode of production with its contrary, that same interest compels him in the colonies to make a clean breast of it and to proclaim aloud the antagonism of the two modes of production. To this end, he proves how the development of the social productive power of labour, cooperation, division of labour, use of machinery on a large scale, etc., are impossible without the expropriation of the labourers and the corresponding transformation of their means of production into capital. In the interest of the so-called national wealth, he seeks for artificial means to ensure the poverty of the people. Here his apologetic armour crumbles off bit by bit like rotten touchwood. It is the great merit of E.G. Wakefield to have discovered not anything new about the colonies, but to have discovered in the colonies the truth as to the conditions of capitalist production in the mother country. As the system of protection at its origin, later it became a temporary necessity in the international competitive struggle, but whatever its motive, the consequences remain the same, attempted to manufacture capitalists artificially in the mother country, so Wakefield's colonization theory, which England tried for a time to enforce by Acts of Parliament, attempted to effect the manufacture of wage workers in the colonies. This he calls systematic colonization. Footnote: Wakefield's few glimpses on the subject of modern colonization are fully anticipated by Mirabeau Père, the physiocrat, and even much earlier by English economists. End of footnote. First of all, Wakefield discovered that in the colonies, property in money, means of subsistence, machines, and other means of production does not as yet stamp a man as a capitalist if there be wanting the correlative, the wage worker, the other man who is compelled to sell himself of his own free will. He discovered that capital is not a thing, but a social relation between persons, established by the instrumentality of things. Footnote: a Negro is a Negro. In certain circumstances, he becomes a slave. A mule is a machine for spinning cotton. Only under certain circumstances does it become capital. Outside these circumstances, it is no more capital than gold is intrinsically money, or sugar is the price of sugar. Capital is a social relation of production. It is a historical relation of production. Karl Marx, Lohnarbeit und Kapital, 1849. End of footnote. Mr. Peel, he moans, took with him from England to Swan River, West Australia, means of subsistence and of production to the amount of £50,000. Mr. Peel had the foresight to bring with him, besides, 300 persons of the working class, men, women, and children. Once arrived at his destination, Mr. Peel was left without a servant to make his bed or fetch him water from the river. Footnote, E.G. Wakefield, England and America. End of footnote. Unhappy Mr. Peel, who provided for everything except the export of English modes of production to Swan River. For the understanding of the following discoveries of Wakefield, two preliminary remarks. We know that the means of production and subsistence, while they remain the property of the immediate producer, are not capital. They become capital only under circumstances in which they serve at the same time as means of exploitation and subjection of the labourer. But this capitalist soul of theirs is so intimately wedded in the head of the political economist to their material substance that he christens them capital under all circumstances, even when they are its exact opposite. Thus is it with Wakefield. Further, the splitting up of the means of production into the individual property of many independent labourers working on their own account, he calls equal division of capital. It is with the political economist as with the feudal jurist. The latter stuck on to pure monetary relations, the labels supplied by feudal law. If, says Wakefield, all members of the society are supposed to possess equal portions of capital, no man would have a motive for accumulating more capital than he could use with his own hands. This is to some extent the case in new American settlements, where a passion for owning land prevents the existence of a class of labourers for hire. So long, therefore, as the labourer can accumulate for himself, and this he can do, so long as he remains possessor of his means of production, capitalist accumulation and the capitalistic mode of production are impossible. The class of wage labourers, essential to these, is wanting. How, then, in old Europe, was the expropriation of the labourer from his conditions of labour, that is, the coexistence of capital and wage labour, brought about? By a social contract of a quite original kind. Mankind have adopted a simple contrivance for promoting the accumulation of capital, which, of course, since the time of Adam, floated in their imagination as the sole and final end of their existence. They have divided themselves into owners of capital and owners of labour. The division was the result of concert and combination. In one word, the mass of mankind expropriated itself in honour of the accumulation of capital. Now, one would think that this instinct of self-denying fanaticism would give itself full fling, especially in the colonies, where alone exist the men and conditions that could turn a social contract from a dream to a reality. But why, then, should systematic colonization be called in to replace its opposite, spontaneous, unregulated colonization? In the northern states of the American Union, it may be doubted whether so many as a tenth of the people would fall under the description of hired labourers. In England, the labouring class composed the bulk of the people. Nay, the impulse to self-expropriation on the part of labouring humanity for the glory of capital exists so little that slavery, according to Wakefield himself, is the sole natural basis of colonial wealth. His systematic colonization is a mere pis-aller, last resort, since he unfortunately has to do with free men, not with slaves. The first Spanish settlers in San Domingo did not obtain labourers from Spain, but without labourers, their capital must have perished, or at least must soon have been diminished to that small amount which each individual could employ with his own hands. This has actually occurred in the last colony founded by England, the Swan River Settlement, where a great mass of capital, of seeds, implements, and cattle, has perished for want of labourers to use it, and where no settler has preserved much more capital than he can employ with his own hands. We have seen that the expropriation of the mass of the people from the soil forms the basis of the capitalist mode of production. The essence of a free colony, on the contrary, consists in this: that the bulk of the soil is still public property, and every settler on it therefore can turn part of it into his private property and individual means of production, without hindering the later settlers in the same operation. Footnote: land, to be an element of colonization, must not only be waste, but it must be public property, liable to be converted into private property. End of footnote. This is the secret both of the prosperity of the colonies and of their inveterate vice, opposition to the establishment of capital. Where land is very cheap and all men are free, where everyone who so pleases can easily obtain a piece of land for himself, not only is labour very dear, as respects the labourer's share of the produce, but the difficulty is to obtain combined labour at any price. As in the colonies, the separation of the labourer from the conditions of labour and their root, the soil, does not exist, or only sporadically, or on too limited a scale. So neither does the separation of agriculture from industry exist, nor the destruction of the household industry of the peasantry. Whence, then, is to come the internal market for capital? No part of the population of America is exclusively agricultural, excepting slaves and their employers who combine capital and labour in particular works. Free Americans, who cultivate the soil, follow many other occupations. Some portion of the furniture and tools which they use is commonly made by themselves. They frequently build their own houses and carry to market, at whatever distance, the produce of their own industry. They are spinners and weavers. They make soap and candles, as well as, in many cases, shoes and clothes for their own use. In America, the cultivation of land is often the secondary pursuit of a blacksmith, a miller, or a shopkeeper. With such queer people as these, where is the field of abstinence for the capitalists? The great beauty of capitalist production consists in this: that it not only constantly reproduces the wage worker as wage worker, but produces always, in proportion to the accumulation of capital, a relative surplus population of wage workers. Thus, the law of supply and demand of labour is kept in the right rut. The oscillation of wages is penned within limits satisfactory to capitalist exploitation. And lastly, the social dependence of the labour on the capitalist, that indispensable requisite, is secured. An unmistakable relation of dependence which the smug political economist, at home in the mother country, can transmogrify into one of free contract between buyer and seller, between equally independent owners of commodities, the owner of the commodity capital and the owner of the commodity labour. But in the colonies, this pretty fancy is torn asunder. The absolute population here increases much more quickly than in the mother country, because many labourers enter this world as ready-made adults, and yet the labour market is always understocked. The law of supply and demand of labour falls to pieces. On the one hand, the old world constantly throws in capital, thirsting after exploitation and abstinence. On the other, the regular reproduction of the wage labourer as wage labourer comes into collision with impediments the most impertinent and, in part, invincible. What becomes of the production of wage labourers, supernumerary in proportion to the accumulation of capital? The wage worker of today is tomorrow an independent peasant or artisan working for himself. He vanishes from the labour market, but not into the workhouse. This constant transformation of the wage labourers into independent producers who work for themselves instead of for capital and enrich themselves instead of the capitalist gentry reacts in its turn very perversely on the conditions of the labour market. Not only does the degree of exploitation of the wage labourer remain indecently low, the wage labourer loses into the bargain, along with the relation of dependence, also the sentiment of dependence on the abstemious capitalist. Hence all the inconveniences that our E.G. Wakefield pictures so doughtily, so eloquently, so pathetically. The supply of wage labour, he complains, is neither constant, nor regular, nor sufficient. The supply of labour is always not only small but uncertain. Though the produce divided between the capitalist and the labourer be large, the labourer takes so great a share that he soon becomes a capitalist. Few, even those whose lives are unusually long, can accumulate great masses of wealth. The labourers most distinctly decline to allow the capitalist to abstain from the payment of the greater part of their labour. It avails him nothing if he is so cunning as to import from Europe, with his own capital, his own wage workers. They soon cease to be labourers for hire. They become independent landowners, if not competitors with their former masters in the labour market. Think of the horror. The excellent capitalist has imported bodily from Europe with his own good money, his own competitors. The end of the world has come. No wonder Wakefield laments the absence of all dependence and of all sentiment of dependence on the part of the wage workers in the colonies. On account of the high wages, says his disciple Merivale, there is in the colonies the urgent desire for cheaper and more subservient labourers, for a class to whom the capitalist might dictate terms instead of being dictated to by them. In ancient civilised countries, the labourer, though free, is by law of nature dependent on capitalists. In colonies, this dependence must be created by artificial means. Footnote. Merivale. Even the mild, free trade, vulgar economist Molinari says, in the colonies where slavery has been abolished without the compulsory labour being replaced with an equivalent quantity of free labour, there has occurred the opposite of what happens every day before our eyes. Simple workers have been seen to exploit in their turn the industrial entrepreneurs, demanding from them wages which bear absolutely no relation to the legitimate share in the product which they ought to receive. The planters were unable to obtain for their sugar for a sufficient price to cover the increase in wages, and were obliged to furnish the extra amount at first out of their profits and then out of their very capital. A considerable amount of planters have been ruined as a result, while others have closed down their businesses in order to avoid the ruin which threatened them. It is doubtless better that these accumulations of capital should be destroyed than that generations of men should perish. How generous, Mr. Molinari! But would it not be better if both survived? Molinari. Mr. Molinari, Mr. Molinari! What then becomes of the Ten Commandments, of Moses and the Prophets, of the law of supply and demand, if in Europe the entrepreneur can cut down the labourer's legitimate part, and in the West Indies the labourer can cut down the entrepreneur's? And what, if you please, is this legitimate part, which on your own showing the capitalist in Europe daily neglects to pay? over yonder in the colonies where the labourers are so simple as to exploit the capitalist, Mr. Molinari feels a strong itching to set the law of supply and demand that works elsewhere automatically on the right road by means of the police. End of footnote. What is now, according to Wakefield, the consequence of this unfortunate state of things in the colonies? A barbarizing tendency of dispersion of producers and national wealth. The parcelling out of the means of production among innumerable owners, working on their own account, annihilates, along with the centralization of capital, all the foundation of combined labor. Every long-winded undertaking, extending over several years and demanding outlay of fixed capital, is prevented from being carried out. In Europe, capital invests without hesitating a moment, for the working class constitutes its living appurtenance, always in excess, always at disposal. But in the colonies, Wakefield tells an extremely doleful anecdote. He was talking with some capitalists of Canada and the state of New York, where the immigrant wave often becomes stagnant and deposits a sediment of supernumerary labourers. "Our capital," says one of the characters in the melodrama, "was ready for many operations which require a considerable period of time for their completion, but we could not begin such operations with labour which, we knew, would soon leave us. If we had been sure of retaining the labour of such emigrants, we should have been glad to have engaged it at once, and for a high price, and we should have engaged it even though we had been sure it would leave us, provided we had been sure of a fresh supply whenever we might need it." After Wakefield has constructed the English capitalist agriculture and its combined labour with the scattered cultivation of American peasants, he unwittingly gives us a glimpse at the reverse of the medal. He depicts the mass of the American people as well-to-do, independent, enterprising, and comparatively cultured, whilst the English agricultural labourer is a miserable wretch, a pauper. In what country, except North America and some new colonies, do the wages of free labour employed in agriculture much exceed a bare subsistence for the labourer? Undoubtedly, farm horses in England, being a valuable property, are better fed than English peasants. But never mind. National wealth is, once again, by its very nature, identical with misery of the people. How, then, to heal the anti-capitalistic cancer of the colonies? If men were willing, at a blow, to turn all the soil from public into private property, they would destroy certainly the root of the evil, but also the colonies. The trick is how to kill two birds with one stone. Let the government put upon the virgin soil an artificial price, independent of the law of supply and demand, a price that compels the immigrant to work a long time for wages before he can earn enough money to buy land and turn himself into an independent peasant. Footnote. It is, you add, a result of the appropriation of the soil and of capital that the man who has nothing but the strength of his arms finds employment and creates an income for himself. But the opposite is true. It is thanks to the individual appropriation of the soil that there exist men who only possess the strength of their arms. When you put a man in a vacuum, you rob him of the air. You do the same when you take away the soil from him, for you are putting him in a space void of wealth, so as to leave him no way of living except according to your wishes. Collins. End of footnote. The fund resulting from the sale of land at a price relatively prohibitory for the wage workers, this fund of money extorted from the wages of labour by violation of the sacred law of supply and demand, the government is to employ, on the other hand, in proportion as it grows. To import have-nothings from Europe into the colonies, and thus keep the wage-labour market full for the capitalists. Under these circumstances, everything will be for the best in the best of all possible worlds. This is the great secret of systematic colonization. By this plan, Wakefield cries in triumph, the supply of labour must be constant and regular, because, first, as no labourer would be able to procure land until he had worked for money, all immigrant labourers, working for a time for wages and in combination, would produce capital for the employment of more labourers. Secondly, because every labourer who left off working for wages and became a landowner would, by purchasing land, provide a fund for bringing fresh labour to the colony. The price of soil imposed by the state must, of course, be a sufficient price, that is, so high as to prevent the labourers from becoming independent landowners until others had followed to take their place. This sufficient price for the land is nothing but a euphemistic circumlocution for the ransom which the labourer pays to the capitalist for leave to retire from the wage-labour market to the land. First, he must create for the capitalist capital, with which the latter may be able to exploit more labourers. Then he must place, at his own expense, a locum tenens, placeholder, on the labour market, whom the government forwards across the sea for the benefit of his old master, the capitalist. It is very characteristic that the English government for years practised this method of primitive accumulation prescribed by Mr. Wakefield expressly for the use of the colonies. The fiasco was, of course, as complete as that of Sir Robert Peel's Bank Act. The stream of emigration was only diverted from the English colonies to the United States. Meanwhile, the advance of capitalistic production in Europe, accompanied by increasing government pressure, has rendered Wakefield's recipe superfluous. On the one hand, the enormous and ceaseless stream of men year after year driven upon America leaves behind a stationary sediment in the east of the United States. The wave of immigration from Europe throwing men on the labour market there more rapidly than the wave of emigration westwards can wash them away. On the other hand, the American Civil War brought in its train a colossal national debt, and with it pressure of taxes, the rise of the vilest financial aristocracy, the squandering of a huge part of the public land on speculative companies for the exploitation of railways, mines, etc. In brief, the most rapid centralization of capital. The Great Republic has, therefore, ceased to be the promised land for emigrant labourers. Capitalistic production advances there with giant strides, even though the lowering of wages and the dependence of the wage worker are yet far from being brought down to the normal European level. The shameless lavishing of uncultivated colonial land on aristocrats and capitalists by the government, so loudly denounced even by Wakefield, has produced, especially in Australia, in conjunction with the stream of men that the gold diggings attract, and with the competition that the importation of English commodities causes even to the smallest artisan, an ample, relative, surplus labouring population, so that almost every mail brings the Job's news of a glut of the Australia labour market, and the prostitution in some places flourishes as wantonly as in the London Haymarket. Footnote. As soon as Australia became her own lawgiver, she passed, of course, laws favourable to the settlers, but the squandering of the land already accomplished by the English government stands in the way. The first and main object at which New Land Act of 1862 aims is to give increased facilities for the settlement of the people. The Land Law of Victoria, by the Honourable C. G. Duffy, Minister of Public Lands, London, 1862. End of footnote. However, we are not concerned here with the conditions of the colonies. The only thing that interests us is the secret discovered in the New World by the political economy of the Old World and proclaimed on the housetops, that the capitalist mode of production and accumulation, and therefore capitalist private property, have for their fundamental condition the annihilation of self-earned private property. In other words, the expropriation of the labourer. Derek LePage was reading Capital, Volume 1, by Karl Marx. Details of further titles released by Ukemi Audiobooks can be found on ukemiaudiobooks.com.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.